Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are available. I'm Adam Johnson, author of The Orphan Master's Son, professor at Stanford University, and your moderator for tonight's program, which is generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation as a part of the club's Good Lit series. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our guest, Richard Powers. Richard Powers is the author of 11 novels, including The Echo Maker, which won the National Book Award. Powers has received numerous other prizes, including a MacArthur Fellowship, two Pushcart Prizes, the Lannan Literary Award, the Ambassador Book Award, and many more. In addition to being a fellow of both the Academy of Arts and Sciences and the Academy of Arts and Letters, Powers has also recently become a professor at Stanford University. His latest book, Orfeo, was released just this past week. Please join me in welcoming Richard Powers to the Commonwealth Club. Richard, it's a great honor to be speaking with you tonight about this fantastic book. I found it really mesmerizing. And I don't know if I've seen a writer engage the topic of music as well as you have. You know, as writers, there are things that are easier to depict than others. It's easy to depict the body in motion, for example. We love to write about sports and dance. But certain things are more abstract, like painting. It's very hard to get that two-dimensional chromatic schema onto the page. And music is notoriously difficult. But it's fabulously done here. How did music become such a large element in the work?
Well, music's been a large element of my work for a long time. And this is actually the third novel of my 11 that takes music as its central material. I've done this twice before at about 10-year intervals, actually. And I guess I find that that when I really need to be refreshed and restore my own sense of the creative potential of words, I turn to music as the place to go. And I guess in part that's because it gives me the excuse to indulge in listening all day long. I just also think there is something ineffable about trying to describe music per se, but there's something of the effect of music on people that's just, to me, irresistible. To somehow get into music from as many different angles as possible, the historical, the socio-political, the physical, the emotional. And to me, it's as good an entree into the mystery of human emotional response as any other subject that I can think of.
Yes. Well, it's a beautiful, fabulous book. For people who haven't read it, the main character is a man named Peter Ells. We get his life story in relation to the music he discovers. In fact, these are the turning points in his life. The realization, the coming to the mount of certain works, grappling with them. And he dedicates his life and identity to the creation of music. And, you know, we follow him through all these iterations. Normally, when I see a writer write about a musician or a mathematician, I think, he's really writing about a writer.
Mm. Well, and I'm certainly doing that to some extent here. So to set this up, Else is born in 1941, and at the time of the story, he's roughly 70, 71 years old. As a young man, he has an aptitude for both science and music, and this is a correlation that I think many of us have observed. The mathematically inclined, those who grasp the structures of chemistry and physics often feel great love for the changing patterns of music. As a young man, he's attracted to kind of late romanticism, the late 19th century music before the great crisis of the 20th century, and when he goes to school, initially to study chemistry, he also carries along with him this musical gift, and he's a performer, and is led to believe by the first great love of his life, that he has a vocation that he can't deny. And he really owes it to himself to cultivate this natural talent, this facility of making sounds. Of course, by the time he's in graduate school, it's the high 60s, and any special gift that you might have to create post-romantic music is not going to help you too much at that moment. And it's at this time that this great crisis that will characterize the rest of his life starts to form. Do you align yourself with the beautiful, the lasting, the legacy, the familiar, the traditional? Or do you commit to trying to make something new, a kind of music that the ear can't hear yet, music that's disturbing or troubling or challenging in some ways? And it's a crisis, I think, that he takes with him through the very end of the book without a final resolution. But this tension between wanting to make something that extends the language of music while at the same time not leaving behind entirely that kind of music that works so well and so robustly for so many people. It's tough to have it both ways, and I think in some ways that's the tragedy of Els's life.
You know, it's interesting how, you know, music and prose narrative share in common the way they unfold in the moment. They're both linear, they exist in time, moment by moment, and yet words can be sung, and we have opera that can fuse those two. But it's very difficult to capture music on the page without learning the language of notation. I felt like a struggle with that. Your book made me wish I could read music, you know, in a certain way.
Well, what I want to do, I guess, in a way to punctuate this man's life is to hear the world the way that he would hear it. And that means going back and listening to these landmark pieces of his lifetime, pieces sometimes less familiar, sometimes more familiar, pieces that are now iconic and are considered almost war horses, but in their day belong to that stream of strange, hostile, or difficult pieces, and to hear them the way that a composer would hear them, but also to hear them the way that they would have been heard in their time, as challenging, as revolutionary, as something for whom we, you know, for which we do not yet have a category. So to find a language that does justice to that, I needed to come at this question in lots of different ways. So there are various set pieces that try to rehear the 20th century in a way that would give meaning to this person's, you know, foundational approach to the world. Mm-hmm. And that can happen historically. For instance, one of the big set pieces in the book is the composition, the circumstances of the composition of Olivier Messiaen's quartet for the End of Time. Messiaen was a prisoner of war, taken very early after the German invasion of France, sent to an exceptionally primitive concentration camp in Silesia, and discovers that he's in this camp with three other musicians of some skill. They have the most rudimentary instruments. You know, they have a cello with three strings, a piano on which the keys go down nicely, but they don't always come back up as well. And the commandant of the camp becomes fascinated with this idea that he has a first-rank French composer among his prisoners. And so somehow in the chaos of the war, he gets staff paper for Messiaen, and he locks him away in solitary confinement and puts a guard on the room so that this man can have the privacy that he needs to make this piece. And the piece gets performed in January of 1941 in, you know, an unheated barrack with the German officers in the front row and these men in their prison uniforms on stage, and a room full of prisoners of war of many nationalities, some of whom had never been to a concert before, let alone exposed to this music from another planet. So I'm thinking, if I can get into the drama, the innate drama of the construction of this piece, and then have my 70-year-old composer go into an assisted living facility where he has a weekly class. And, you know, as so often happens, you know, when a person reaches a certain age, they turn to classical music as somehow some late key to summarizing the mysteries of existence, and have Els try to make this piece, which is so otherworldly and makes such demands on the ear, make it audible and passionate and dramatic to these elderly people. That's a way of making the abstraction, the patterns, the ineffable mysteries of music somehow accessible to the reader of a prose narrative too, to understand in that piece the innate drama that fashions of these raw phenomena, the stuff of human values.
That's right. This sequence in the book in which these prisoners of war fashion the quartet for the end of the time, it's not that long. It's only maybe 12 pages or 15 pages. It reads like a novel within a novel. It's so wonderfully rendered. And here are these people creating art under the most difficult of circumstances. They work. They risk their lives. They give everything. They're under circumstances in which it's difficult to survive, let alone create. And then they finally perform the music to an audience of people who are hungry. They're hypoglycemic. But they're troubled. They're uncertain.
Yeah.
They're baffled by the music. They don't know what to make of it. And it begs these questions in an organic way. How do you make music about the Holocaust? Mm-hmm. You know, where do we find words? Where do you find the notes to speak the experience of life? And we see Peter fall in love, fall out of love, make great risks for his art. And what is the music to accompany that? Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, and that was another challenge of the book too. It was one thing to go to these landmark existing pieces and to listen to them again and again and find some way of opening up what is contained in them. But of course, in order to tell this man's story, I also had to create a discography, if you will, of his pieces. So the other great pleasure of the book was creating a lifetime of work, a fictional work for this man, and find some way of bringing that music onto stage and talk, you know, and it's almost as if I had to create the work itself in a rudimentary form in my head and to hear it before I could begin to describe it physically, which would then be a way into a description of what values were being contested at that point in his life, what he was attempting and failing to do with this music of 50, 60 years.
Mm-hmm. And this charting of this course of music is kind of the backstory for Peter. You know, we see him strike his first notes at the age of 8, and we follow him through to the now and when he's 70. But the forestory is quite interesting. There are some kind of thrillerish elements going on to a degree. I always think of the backstory as the value of a character, and the narrative, the now, is what happens next. And there's a balance. If you don't care about the person, you don't care about what happens next to them. But if it's all, you know, a historical portrait, then you don't want to move forward as well. But what happens in the now is he's doing a biological experiment in his kitchen. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, at the beginning of the story, it feels like something of a leap to discover this aging avant-garde composer joining the do-it-yourself biology movement. And it really isn't until the past, the entire extended past of this 70-year-old life meets up with this whirlwind 4 or 5 days of the present story that you have all the pieces of what it is was driving this and that led him back, in a sense, to the youthful science that he abandoned when he was in school. In a sense, he's after a kind of last avant-garde hurrah, something that will unite the compulsions that he felt as a young man for finding patterns in the living world, in the physical world, with the patterns that he's devoted his life to identifying and extending as a composer. And it's a kind of late-day realization that he's been writing for smaller and smaller audiences, more and more rarefied creations for people less and less able to hear. He is the kind of composer for whom it's often the case that there are more people up on stage than there are down in the audience for premieres of his pieces. And I think as an old man, when he becomes interested again in the way that sound, noise, vibration, pattern permeates the world in ways that we can't hear, he comes up with this sort of final, I think, limit case in which he realizes it would be entirely possible, even with someone of limited skill, to compose a piece of music, encode that in the way that we do when we digitize and make an MP3 file, have an online company convert that into a sequence of DNA nucleotides, and insert it into a living cell. Let that cell propagate through the world. His piece would be everywhere, and no one would be able to hear it. It seems to him, in some ways, a kind of final amen in a strange career that has led him into pushing sound farther and farther into its outer limits. The discovery, by accident, by the police, that this man, who should have no reason whatsoever to have anything aside from a wearing blender in his kitchen, having instead a full do-it-yourself biology lab, does not sit well in post-9/11 America. And that's what propels the present story, an ill-advised idea that if he perhaps hangs low for a couple of days, that they will find out that he's done nothing illegal or objectionable, of course, sets in motion this westward fugitive story. So on the one hand, it's a traditional Künstler roman, you know, a story of an artist's growth and development. And on the other hand, it's fused strangely with this fugitive story, a man way out of his element, and taking the occasion to try to make some last amends as he stays one step ahead of his own data trail.
His own data trail. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's such a wonderful moment when these police show up. We kind of shift their perspectives, and we see this kind of older, this older composer with his deceased dog rolled up in a quilt that turns out to be significant, and he's converted his entire house. He's like baking bacteria in his converted rice cookers, and he has these huge carboils and things spinning, and I felt like I was in that.
You ready to shoot the scene?
I was ready for it. I certainly was. But this idea of his grand work, his overture in the key of RNA, but that will last forever, that will be encoded forever, that is part of our biology, but that can't quite be played back.
Right.
Is there something kind of sad about that? And, you know, we were having coffee beforehand, and I confessed to you that I was writing a longish work that I thought probably no one would ever want to read, and people probably wouldn't be interested in.
At one point or another, actually.
And so, you know, I thought of your character a great deal. Here he is for writing for very small audiences. He's overtly trying to challenge them in ways that are not going to bring them pleasure, mm-hmm. and maybe defy their expectations. And it raises this question, you know, what's the artist's role in a society of dwindling listeners and dwindling readers?
Well, you know, the irony, of course, is that this is an age of tremendous creativity and outpouring in all media. But that, of course, changes and raises the difficulty of having the concentration and attention necessary to have a private and extended, immersive relationship with anything. I mean, one of the questions that really haunts Els is, you know, how can we summon up that focus and attention and concentration that we need to listen to something difficult, something that might not unfold until the 10th or the 11th time, in a world where everything ever written is available to everyone, anywhere, at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this scene, for instance, when he's in a park and watching a jogger as she listens on her mobile device, and she lasts 30 seconds for each track. You know? And you know, it's just this constant sense that the something more interesting or more compelling is just a flick away.
Well, I just to go back to this kitchen that you can tell I want to shoot this scene. You know, this you're ground zero of do-it-yourself culture. This is maker culture here in San Francisco, and I really felt that power going on. You know, a neighbor of mine used to, Steve Silberman, used to write for Wired magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know Steve, he's interviewed you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he talked about how after 9/11, all the chemistry sets and biology sets we used to have as kids all disappeared because they had chemicals in them.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I remember we would go down to Yellowfront and buy carbide, which when mixed with water makes acetylene. And we would make carbide cannons when we were 10,
right.
You know. You know, in writing this article for Wired, he discovered a guy who had created a linear particle accelerator in his backyard. Mm. It was only 100 feet long, but he had got his nuclear material and was shooting atoms across the neighbor's lawn. And, you know, the United States government took that very, very seriously.
In fact, it's no great reveal to confess that this story got its inspiration from the 2004 story of Steve Kurtz. Don't know if this name is going to ring any bells with any of you, but Kurtz was a bio artist, a performance artist in Buffalo, New York, who was arrested for having biological materials in his house, despite the fact that he had a long resume of exhibitions internationally of biological material. And in fact, had an exhibition at a major museum a few weeks away, and should have been able to demonstrate in a matter of hours that this was all legitimate, nothing illegal, and had a perfectly valid artistic basis. In fact, it was a full 4 years before all charges against Kurtz were dropped. And it's that story. That's the starting point of my sense. What I wanted to do then was to take that same basic impetus and make it a little more ambiguous, all right? A little less easy to prove that the artist in question had a valid relationship to that material, but to put, in a sense, the fear of culture that has constituted Elsa's entire life. That stuff is strange. It's disturbing to me. I can't come to terms with it. This message that he's been living with for his entire creative life, to put that fear of culture in collision with the culture of fear, which we all have been living under for the last decade.
And I also wonder, you know, what's been lost by losing this culture in which people can experiment and develop. As a youth, did you do experiments?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't shooting atoms into my neighbor's house, but yeah, that notion of safety that we have now, this sense that somehow by using high tech that we can preserve, we can protect, we can completely manage, and we can, you know, we can smooth over all of the danger of individual recklessness, I think is very much in the heart of this book as well. Mm-hmm. How profoundly the world has changed from the time of Elsa's childhood to the day that he goes on the run.
Right. And you kind of deconstruct what it is to go on the run these days.
Yeah.
It used to be you just needed a six-pack of Schlitz and a pistol and and some cheap motels. But Elsa confronts our data trail at every turn. Is it possible to run anymore?
I should say first, just before we leave entirely this notion of embedding art into the genome.
Yes.
This is entirely possible and has been done many times by many artists all the way back. I think the earliest that I know about is 1999 with Eduardo Koch, who the Brazilian bio artist, who took that line from Genesis, let man have dominion over the fish in the sea and the birds in the air and everything that creeps upon the earth. He took that line, encoded it, inserted it into an organism, and then put that, here's the brilliant twist on this, he put that organism into a petri dish and in a museum setting with an ultraviolet light and a button that would then beam mutagens down on this dish. So if you walked by and you saw this and you thought, I don't like this. I don't think man should have dominion over the fish in the sea and the birds in the air. I can press this button and mutate this thing so that the text gets garbled and it's lost, right? But of course, by doing that, I am taking dominion over this creature, right? I am changing it, right? And similarly, you know, if you do believe that man should have such dominion, right? And you see this insertion and you walk past it, then it is your God-given right to have that intervention, right? In any case, the problem with the world is it cannot be made safe, either from malicious people or from artists, right? And I think once else goes on the lamb, to come back to this question of how data comes back into the story, he realizes that the same things that have interested him in the course of his life, the acquisition of patterns, the finding of patterns in living things, the converting, the analyzing, the manipulation of these patterns, has been raised to such a level that now that he's on the wrong side of the security state, he can't run his credit card through a gas pump. Right. He can't use his phone, right? He can't pull into a motel without being on a security camera. Mm. And so the flight is doomed from the beginning, right? Because of the fact that the audience that he never had is suddenly very interested in him, and they're able to hear everything that he does.
I want to go back to this insertion of DNA. I mean, don't we push that button every time we use hand sanitizer on our hands?
Yeah. I mean, I've had many interesting readings of the book so far. And one that surprised me but was very stimulating was someone reacting to horror at this idea that anyone might use the genome as an aesthetic sandbox, mm-hmm. right? That somehow that just seemed obscene, and the analogy was that would be like spray painting graffiti on the Parthenon.
I looked at the Parthenon 2 weeks ago, and it's covered with graffiti.
Well, yeah. The difference, of course, is that there is no such thing as the genome, right? It is not the Parthenon. It's the New York Stock Exchange on an especially manic day. There are 17 gazillion Parthenons, right? And it is self-graffitiing all the time, right? And the use of it as an aesthetic, as a point of aesthetic contemplation, right? It sets in motion, yes, something that does take dominion over the fish in the sea. But it is, as you say, not distinguishable from the alteration of life that's happening all the time by our deliberate or non-deliberate actions. And, you know, my reply also was, to some extent, is it more obscene for an artist to use the genome than it is for Monsanto to use the genome mm-hmm. and to sell it to us every day in our supermarkets? Mm-hmm. So these two are issues in the book. How much safety do you need? How much safety do you believe you can get? What are you willing to pay for those safeties? What is art's role in challenging the basic notion of the stability and safety of life?
I know a lot of our sequence is nonce pairing. I mean, if you could put Moby Dick into your sequence, I know a lot of people would say, let's have it. I want it in my genetics. Or a gene could be inserted to make a part of your skin bioluminesce, and that could be a club thing, right?
In fact, put a little logo in it. as the book was going to press, I read of a group in Great Britain, a bioinformatics group in Great Britain, mail ordering a DNA encoding of about 700 kilobytes of data, including a PDF, a short audio clip of Martin Luther King, I think, and having that sequence created for them and then sent across the world, at which point they then simply resequenced and extracted that data back out. In other words, using this, you know, nucleic acid material as a storage medium. Right? The other amazing thing that happened after the book went to press, you know, here I was laboring on this thing for 4 or 5 years thinking, maybe I'm really overstating this case. You know, maybe all this paranoia about being watched and recreating the Kurtz story, you know, 7 years later, maybe I'm telling yesterday's story. You know, I'm going to put it out there and people are going to say, well, you know, that's a little bit, you know, hyperbolic. And then Snowden broke. You know, as the book was just, as I was proofing galleys, basically. And at that point, I thought, you know, I've underestimated this. I want to go back and fix this story. Right?
Hmm. The you know, the critic John Freeman has called you one of the world's most intelligent authors. And I don't know how you feel about that.
And I think
that
he's a very intelligent critic.
There you go.
But I do know that you're a relentlessly curious individual. And you're the kind of person, if you say, whoa, I just had some deja vu, Richard Powers would say, actually, that's when a synapse, I just read a study, leaps from the hypothalamus to this, and there's actually a limbic part in the brain that, you know, that when you speak with him, there's always a derivation, a source for this in our biology. And I see this in your work, whether it's, you know, the Capgras syndrome in the Echo Maker, in which there's a biological source for a terrible condition in which people cannot identify their loved ones, or in Generosity, a biological source for this kind of innate optimism that sometimes we feel. Here we go back to genetics. As someone who traces our personalities and aspects of our identities back to our biology, it makes me wonder, you know, do you think human personalities are more floral, you know, have more possibility, or is it reductive? I mean, do we have as much free will to act as spontaneously as we feel we are when really it's just our biology?
That's a terrific question, and it gives me the opportunity to correct what I think has been sometimes a misunderstanding about my project. I do not want to understand people in terms of their underwriting biology. Right? I do not want to reduce the everyday miraculous to some kind of easy to identify set of relations or formulas, right? I want to do the opposite. I want to make the miraculous a million times more incomprehensible by showing all of the component parts that are so invisible to us, both below us and above us. I want to throw open that story of what it means to be human and the terrain of the novel for understanding people. I don't want to reduce people to simple scientific reductions. I want to say, you thought it was amazing. Well, the tightrope act that you work at for the smallest thing, for walking across the room, is so many times more incomprehensible than you ever imagined. Mm-hmm. You know, it reminds me of that the passage at the end of Origin of Species. And, you know, Darwin, who's put off writing this for as long as possible because he knows what kind of firestorm it's going to open up, says, I can't do it from memory, but, you know, it's something to the effect of, it has not escaped my attention that this is going to be upsetting to some people, right? But he then says, you know, he then makes the case that what the phrase is something like, there is a grandeur in this view of life, that is the evolutionary view of life, that might surpass any theology that you've already come up with, because it's so much more, it's so much more contingent and inexorable and involved, and the full view of that picture is more miraculous than angels, right? And that conclusion to that passage where he says, you know, that to imagine that as the planet has gone spinning on through space over these uncountable eons, that life has gone on spinning out these endless forms most beautiful. That's the story that I want to put into the novel. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to make the novel big enough, capacious enough, so that these compelling narratives of who gets to marry who and who's going to betray whom and all these things that we're traditionally so good at when we write stories also gets linked into these incredibly rich and evocative stories below that level and above that level.
Mm. That's right? A beautiful response. Thank you.
Katharine Hepburn has this justifiably famous line in Philadelphia Story about how the time to make up your mind about other people is never. Right? That's the work of the novel. Right? But there are even more ways not to make your mind up about people than you thought. Right? And there are more stories that you can bring into this incredible negotiation that we're doing every day of our lives.
Darwin did shake the world up. It was a radical notion. He changed our cosmogony, you know.
For some of us, this is the United
States.
That's true.
That's true. That's true. I've not made up my mind about all of our citizens. For some of us, you know, I feel personally closer to Peter Ells, who's laboring in the dark. Mm. Here he is. He believes that he has a vision of music. It's a deeply considered vision. It's very personal. It isn't just a notion in his mind. He acts on it, and he sacrifices for it. He gives up the most important things in his life for his art. And it's never celebrated. It's never really heralded by other people except for one occasion. Mm. And yet, you know, he's rhapsodic as he speaks about music. I couldn't hear his music because it's a novel, you know. But, you know, there's a moment in a cafe where he, you know, processes some music he's listening to that it's utterly oracular. But, you know, this is a question I ask myself. Is it worth it, you know, to be a novelist, to sacrifice my family and time away from the things that are important to me, to make literature that may not be read by others?
Yeah. You had made a gesture toward that earlier in the conversation about whenever writers write about music, they're actually writing about writing, and I think it's true. But so two things. I mean, you recognize this tension between wanting to make it new, mm-hmm. but also to make it readable, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, when if you look at Orphan Master's Son, I mean, it is a novel that relishes storytelling and revels in the personal and the urgent and the attempt to pull meaning out of a meaningless situation. Mm-hmm. But you're also pushing what the novel can do by creating these allegories and these, you know, these textures of narration that don't look quite like any other book. Mm-hmm. So you must feel to some extent too that tension between how much load can the novel bear before the traditional reader who just wants to find out what's going to happen to these people breaks down.
Yeah.
But then this other question of personal cost, mm-hmm. I think, is one that everybody who wants to do something ambitious has to ask himself.
Yeah. Well, I believe in the institution of literature. I believe in in creation. I believe that, you know, I'm not who I am unless I'm making something. And this happens to be my gift for making. But so compelling and convincing is your character that, you know, he is fraught with these questions, and we watch him sacrifice and ask others to sacrifice for his vision. And it made me, as I read, say, why do I write my stories? Why do I go away and make this stuff?
And the reality is, there is no test at the end of the day where you can say that sacrifice was worthwhile. I did a good thing, you know. By hitting my sister up for that $20,000 loan that I never repaid, or you know, neglecting my kids while writing my magnum opus, or whatever that cost is. You cannot do a cost benefit and say I'm out ahead or behind. And you know, it's interesting. I got a wonderful letter yesterday from the great science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson. He had no patience for this romantic impulse. He's saying art should be a carpentry, right? It has no more right to interfere with another person's life than anything else, right? And his model was Dvorak in the kitchen. You know, his idea of the healthy artist is this person who's trying to write music while the kids are bawling and he's rushing up and down to try to keep the dinner cooking, and you know, the house is a chaos, but he's somehow managing to hold it together and still tinkering away on the New World Symphony, right? And I think that's a lovely, healthy vision of artistic creation too. My hope was to create in this guy an ambition that somehow would produce some degree of sympathy. He wants something, right? He wants to find a language that's just a little bit richer than the one that he was given, right? But to see him systematically make these sacrifices and pay these prices, and have the reader, you know, like the frog in the water that keeps getting warmer, at some point, you know, either having to jump or get boiled along with this guy, To me, that was the forward motor of the story, was to create somebody who ends up perhaps doing something monstrous, but for reasons that every step along the way have a kind of aesthetic defensiveness or logic to them.
Mm. Well, with no spoilers, I won't let anyone know what happens to this altered DNA bacteria, whether the government catches our desperate composer on the lam. But toward the end of the book, there's just this beautiful passage. Again, it feels oracular to me. It's as lyric and beautiful as writing can get. But I found deeply, deeply moving and affirmational, in which, you know, our artist contemplates oblivion and love and beauty and duty and the calling of art in a really profound way. And that I was pushed so far with those questions, and then I came back to what I believed was very satisfying for me.
Thanks.
At this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Adam Johnson, author and Stanford University professor, and your moderator for tonight's program, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Our guest tonight is National Book Award-winning author Richard Powers, discussing his latest novel, Orfeo. At this point, we have some questions from the audience. Thank you. I feel like I have a duty to read the first one that was delivered, just because punctuality should be championed in our society a little more than it is, and I have not screened these questions. I'm going to put on my glasses. So are you ready? Do you need a moment? Okay. So many of your books contain music. What kind of musical training have you had?
Ooh. I like getting a nice slow pitch over the center of the plate for the first question. At first I sang. I'm the fourth of five kids. All my brothers and sisters sang from the earliest age. We had our own little self-contained ensemble. We sang in school choruses, church choirs. So that was my first love, I think as a result, when I listen to music now, I think that vocal music is still a kind of touchstone for me. In some ways, our musical tastes are formed in childhood, and the apple never falls all that far from the tree. You know, by 18, you've kind of decided what it is that moves you, and I hope it's not too depressing to say that I think studies have shown that musical taste basically just becomes a question of more and more refinement as you grow older from then. I also studied cello, learned cello when I was very young. And Moved to Bangkok at the age of 11, and that's not a climate that's particularly hospitable to stringed instruments, so that's when I picked up the clarinet and saxophone. When I came back to the States as an older teenager, like everyone else in my cohort, I had to learn guitar and spend many, many hours picking out the changes from records and learning how to reproduce the sounds that I was falling in love with, and became a songwriter. So that's kind of that's my history. Now as an adult, I'm kind of an autodidact pianist, and take great pleasure at sitting down at the keyboard just for fun every day.
Every day, that's wonderful. Mm. If you believe music's perhaps formed by age of 18, it might have been in the mid-70s for you. Does that seem about right?
Oh, boy. Now here
Tony
comes
Orlando
here comes
and Dawn.
The ugly stuff, yes.
The
right
Captain
there.
And Tenille.
Yeah.
Does the music of Southeast Asia still play a role in your life?
You know, it was formative for me to go there as a child and to realize that my assumptions of universality in music are completely unfounded. Right. There's very little that can be said to be considered musical that will circulate across lots of cultures. So for me, that was a terrifically eye-opening experience to realize that the time for making your mind up about what constitutes music is never.
Right? Well, we like to think of improvisation as being an American invention in our jazz. But improvisation, you know, is alive and well in Cambodia and in Thailand.
That's
and
right.
Korean sanjo and pansori mm-hmm. music. Most of the works you reference, and I wished on the audio version, is there a soundtrack here? Can I get the accompaniment?
It's a great idea. I'm afraid the best you can do at this point is to go to my website, where people have already started to post Spotify lists of all the music mentioned in the book. And when the first one came in and it was 46 tracks, I thought, wow, 46 tracks, you know, that's a lot. And subsequently one has come in that's over 400 tracks. And I didn't realize, I mean, that means I'm mentioning a piece of music on every page, which is sort of frightening. But yeah, it's delightful that you know that people are making this effort to sort of collate this music and giving a chance to the casual listener to hear what it is that's propelling Peter Ellis and forming his sense of what the world sounds like.
Well, that's great. What made you use the myth of Orpheus to inspire Orfeo?
Well, you know, it's one of the oldest and most pervasive stories in the West. And this idea of someone who gets his chops down so well that his little patterns can charm beasts, right, and can even animate stones, right, and who then does the ultimate artistic endeavor, which is go down into the underworld and raise the dead, right. I think he's the only person in classical mythology who ever convinces Hades to release one of his own, right? And he does it with music. Mm-hmm. That's an irresistible story. Mm-hmm. In some ways, well, yeah. I mean, the myth plays lots of different roles throughout the novel. But in some ways, of course, the woman that Els is trying to raise from the dead is his first muse, mm-hmm. and music itself. Right, to somehow as an old man to find a way descending into the underworld to find a way to recover that first urgency and to hear the world with fresh ears.
And isn't this one of the first operas in the Western tradition?
Yeah, the Monteverdi opera of Orfeo is often credited as being the first opera.
I do want to make sure we get some people's questions in because I know people are curious. You've probably heard this question before, but people do want to know about how writers write. What motivates you as a writer, and what's your process?
I'm motivated by connection, by finding links between small lives, local lives, and large processes. I find inspiration everywhere, and a lot of times a story will sit for 10, 15 years or longer before that initial impetus, the thing that I found so compelling, finds its way into a final form. I mean, I remember for my 2003 novel, Time of Our Singing, it started with watching a news clip of Marian Anderson's famous 1939 concert on the Washington Mall. I saw that news clip in 1983. It was almost full 2 decades before I figured out how to tell a story that could include the sense of astonishment that I felt when I saw that clip.
That's a very terrifying answer. 15 years, yeah. 2 decades. People want to hear, I just take 20 minutes at lunch from work.
Right.
I write a few pages and the novels write themselves.
I wish that were the case.
Yeah. People ask me how long does it take to write a short story, and I usually say at least a year. And they never want to hear those answers. Yeah. They just don't like them at all.
But it looked at in a certain way, it's terrifying. Looked at in another way, it should be wonderfully compelling. I mean, that means, you know, that this process, which is really what you're after, right? I mean, you think you're after the final product, but basically what you want to do is be immersed in this sense of appreciation, astonishment, connection, bewilderment. And if you can take that idea and spin it out for a year or a decade or a decade and a half or a lifetime, you've got it made. I mean, one of the pieces that I feature in the book that Adam was referencing is a brilliant piece by Steve Reich called Proverb. It's a 15-minute long piece based entirely on these phased entrances. Well, it's magnificent. It connects late 20th century minimalism to early medieval organum. It's just a magnificent piece, but it's based entirely on a single line in Wittgenstein, which you hear over the course of 15 minutes, I don't know how many times, dozens and dozens of times. The line is, how small a thought it takes to fill a whole life.
Do you want me to answer that? just to follow up on this question, there's the dreaded question that authors get, do you write with a pencil or a pen? But with you, I think it's different, because I know that Proust-like, you wrote reclined, speaking orally, and having a computer software program transliterated onto the screen. And so that reconnected you with the oral tradition. And the last time I had dinner with you, maybe a year ago, you were writing on a tablet with your finger in cursive and actually connecting the human touch to the words themselves.
And the tablet was converting it into type. Which,
that's right.
Yeah. I like having different modalities to write with. And, you know, the books can take you into so many places. They can take you into manic places, into very private and quiet places, into places that you know, with a lot of direct discourse that you want to hear out loud, and into places of slow, you know, expansive, you know, more intimate narration. And I think having different tools to engage these different moods has been very useful to me over the years. Mm-hmm. So at present, I can't say I write a book in any one way. I find the way that I need for whatever the task at hand is.
Wow. Yeah. Here's another question maybe we've heard before, but people are curious about how authors inspire one another, how, you know, there's kind of a great chain of being, you know, in authorship. Who inspires you?
Oh, gosh. Who doesn't? I mean, I guess my real roots are in early 20th century European modernism. So, you know, I've read Proust a number of times, and I just find that an inexhaustible font of something, of amazement. I love the Americans of the mid to late 19th century as well. I'm reading more and more fiction of folks a lot younger than me. And instead of feeling, you know, the anxiety of succession. I'm feeling wonderfully rejuvenated by the kinds of invention that's happening right now in the States.
But how are you going to become crusty and calcified then?
Yeah, there are always ways.
We had an author at Stanford recently, I won't mention his or her name, and he said he said he would never read a writer younger than he. And he was, I won't say he was an older gentleman. And I just thought, you know, that cut off about 95% of everything.
Yeah.
So good for you. Here's a question. In terms of structure and narration, how is Orfeo an Enigma unique when compared to your 10 previous works?
Well, one of the things that I think makes this book unique is that it's much more of a situated story. It's entirely focalized by one protagonist. And it's set in a finite, the present frame of the story is set in a very short period of time. And although the book itself allows for lots of excursions that readers might lift an eyebrow at, you know, especially those who don't feel easy access to concert music or classical music, it's basically the story of one man's passions. In that sense, I think, of course, I've been living in this book for some years and I may have totally lost my perspective, but I think it reads much more as a kind of personal adventure story than anything that I've ever written.
Hmm. Yeah. This is a question from myself. You know, having read some of your books, especially this one, it seemed to me that, if this is too personal, we can just pass on it. It seemed to me that a lot of the questions the book poses are questions that people normally pose toward God. Who are we? How do I respond to being? How do I express the joy and terror of existence? What is oblivion? What is the most important act that I can do here? But this is a very secular book. This is someone outside of that community. Do you feel religiosity in your writing? Is it this a response in a certain way for you?
You know, I'm thinking again of that last passage in Darwin, how he does not want to replace the spiritual questions of mankind with the mechanistic explanations. He wants to give a more mature, a richer, a more fundamental ground for the spiritual questions of existence. And that speaks very, very personally to me. I am an atheist. I do not see the need for a deliberate designer. But what I see with the self-designing, it is a deeply religious thing, if that makes any sense at all. And you know, my books, and this book in particular, are littered with the language of religion. Mm-hmm. And it's not surprising, right? I mean, think of music's close relationship to religion. I mean, the real backbone of the 1,200-year history of written music in the West is religion, right? Here's the thing that is a matter of great mystery to me, and great refreshment and great spiritual intensity. I can think of many good reasons of why a social animal, a social intelligent animal, needs story. Right? In fact, I'm teaching a course right now at Stanford in evolutionary psychology and narrative. Right? In a sense, we don't need big brains. I mean, animals have already solved this search for prey, evasion of prey and search for food, with a lot less hardware than we have, right? But the moment we try to form social groups, the problem of existence becomes astronomical. You know, as Shakespeare says, who's up, who's down, who's in, who's out. That's a lot of work to do. And for that, we need a lot of brain, right? And in a sense, it's being able to do theory of mind. You know, she thinks that he was dissing her when she told me, right? That those kinds of maneuvers that we do, you know, every day on Facebook, right, are enormously complicated. And for that, we need story to take all of those complex processes and put it into a concise, elegant, streamlined, memorable, causal, coherent frame. That's called making stories. Right? So to me, it's quite clear why there is a universal compulsion to find story where there may be none, to relate our lives in terms of story. Right? All of that is quite clear. What isn't clear to me is why that melody that you were just humming, you know, under your breath as you drove here, right, should obsess you, right? And why you can hear, you know, turn the radio on in your car, and suddenly be, you know, weeping or laughing, you know, or singing along before the end of the course. Why do we have that? Why should music be so emotionally compelling to us? There are theories, you know, kin selection, you know. Somehow, the better singer of songs, the one with the better memory for the melody du jour, you know, is going to be a more attractive. It's a little bit of a stretch to me, and it doesn't explain, you know, the B minor mass, you know, let alone, you know, Rock Around the Clock. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess what I'm saying is, music itself invites a kind of religious awe, right? And we are more likely to feel that kind of oceanic expansiveness in the presence of that great mystery, a compelling melody, as we are anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. When we were speaking about, you know, music earlier, the music that moves me, of course, is vocal. You know, a cappella music I found tremendously transporting, especially live. Mm. And it's that, you know, that oral voice that speaks from narrative, even if it's third person. But you said the lyric is less valuable. The words in music don't speak as loudly to your heart.
What I meant was, when I hear a song for the first time, you know, it's 85% chord change. That's just how I hear, you know. And I want ingenuity. I want, you know, not surprisingly, I guess, based, you know, if judging from the fiction that I write. The more that melody journeys through the surprising but inevitable chords, the more compelling it is to me. I don't listen to the words at first, but the beautiful thing about music is you keep coming back, and the thing that hooks you is not always the same thing that makes it grow, and each subsequent listening can propel you into more and more links. And, you know, even a banal, you know, country and western song about you know, she was here a minute ago and what happened, right? Can move me to tears if that mix between the words and the music somehow touches off that primal sense of mystery that we all had as children when we were learning, taking in tunes with our mother's milk.
Yeah, we had a conversation about Shostakovich earlier. I was way out of my league. I was deeply intimidated to discuss that composer with you. Can you share with us, before we close, one guilty pleasure of listening?
Well, I will say, in all honesty, I've reached at 56 a kind of wisdom that realizes there can't be any guilt when it comes to listening. Just listen. You know, just listen. Listen to everything that you can. There'll be plenty of times later, you know, to make your mind up about what you're hearing, right? And with luck, you can postpone that sense of guilt or obligation, you know, until your grave.
Our thanks to the Bernard Osher Foundation for underwriting this program, and to Richard Powers, National Book Award winner and author of the new novel Orfeo. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Adam Johnson, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.